Okay, today is April 2nd, 2016. So we start with the homage to the Buddha three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so I have to relearn how to give a class since it's just 3 months. I've fallen out of the routine. I'll stand so people can see me in the back. Okay, so today we will be continuing. Now we're sort of coming into the final stretch with the middle length discourses. We started this back in, could have been late 2009, early 2010. So now it's about 6 years that we've been going through. So there are still enough suttas to keep us engaged. April, May, probably through June. And so today we come to a sutta, it's called the Nandakovada Sutta. Nandakovada Sutta. So this is a discourse called Ovada means instruction. And the monk who gives the instruction is named Nandaka, Venerable Nandaka. And Venerable Nandaka was designated by the Buddha. The Buddha designated numbers of monks, nuns, lay men and lay women who excelled in particular areas. So for example, Sariputta was the disciple, the monk disciple who was foremost in Panya wisdom. Moggallana, the foremost in psychic powers. Mahakashyapa, the foremost in the ascetic practices. And Venerable Nandaka was designated the monk who was foremost in giving instructions to bhikkhunis. Even though there's only one sutta in the whole Sutta Pitaka which exemplifies his instruction to bhikkhunis, and this is the sutta. Okay, so it starts off when the Buddha was living at Savati, at the Jetavana Monastery. Okay, and then Mahaprajapati Gotami comes together with 500 bhikkhunis in order to see the Buddha, the Blessed One. And I think everybody knows who Mahaprajapati Gotami is. She was the Buddha's foster mother. And because King Suddhodana was married both to the Buddha's mother, Mahamaya, and Mahaprajapati Gotami, so she was at once his foster mother, because his mother passed away shortly after his birth. And she was also his aunt. And then after the King Suddhodana passed away, then Mahaprajapati, together with 500 of the Sakya women, requested to become bhikkhunis. And so they became the first Buddhist nuns, and Gotami became like the head or leader of this group of nuns, the spokeswoman, spokes nun. for the other nuns. And so she comes to the Buddha and she asks the Buddha to advise, or this really means to instruct the bhikkhunis, to give a teaching to the bhikkhunis, to give a Dhamma talk to the bhikkhunis. And now it was a practice that the Buddha had established for the Sangha that, you see, because the Buddha would be living close to the monks, and so the Buddha would give, very often he would be giving discourses which the monks would get to hear, but the bhikkhunis would be living at another location, wouldn't get to hear. So in order for the instruction to pass on to the bhikkhunis, he would request a bhikkhu to go at regular intervals to the bhikkhuni quarters in order to give instructions to the bhikkhunis. In fact, this became a regular procedure within the monastic regulations that every 2 weeks, that is on the Uposatha, the day of the religious observance, a monk would have to go to the bhikkhuni quarters in order to give a discourse to the bhikkhunis. Okay, so this is the background to the sutta, where the text says that on that occasion the elder bhikkhus were taking turns in advising or instructing the bhikkhunis, but the venerable Nandaka did not want to advise them or to instruct them when his turn came. I think the commentary says that whenever Nandaka's turn came, he would find some excuse, like he would go to, you know, to visit another village some distance away, or he would get involved in some activity like sewing robes. So they would come and say, it's your turn to instruct the bhikkhunis. Either he's not there, or, oh, I'm too busy, can't do it. And then the commentary gives an explanation, so the question comes, why does Nandaka always try to escape this obligation, this responsibility of instructing the bhikkhunis? The text doesn't give an explanation, the canonical text, but the commentary gives an explanation. And as I often say, when it comes to commentaries, you have to remember that this is something coming down in the narrative tradition. So often we have to take what the commentary says with a grain of salt. You know, it could be like preachers wanting to make the text more interesting, and so they throw in a little legendary story, and then it becomes part of the commentary. So what the commentary says is that in a previous life, Nandaka had been a king, and these 500 bhikkhunis had been his harem. And so he, maybe over several lifetimes, he had been a king, a prince, and the women who became the bhikkhunis had been the members of his harem. And he was afraid that there would be some monk who has the ability to see into past lives, and they would see Nandaka surrounded by the 500 bhikkhunis, and they would think, why is this happening? Ah, back in that past life, he was the king surrounded by the 500 women of the court, and so they can't break their ties to one another. They're sort of bound to each other by these ties of affection. And so for that reason, he tried to escape this regular obligation of instructing the bhikkhunis. Okay, but now the Buddha inquires into this and says, whose turn is it today to instruct the bhikkhunis? And Ananda says that it's Nandaka's turn, but he doesn't want to instruct them. Okay, so then the Buddha addresses Nandaka and tells him to instruct the bhikkhunis. And then Venerable Nandaka, because now he's getting the command coming from the command center, from the Buddha himself, so he has to accept the Buddha's injunction. Okay, so Venerable Nandaka goes over to the bhikkhuni's quarters, and when the bhikkhunis see him coming, then they prepare the seat for him, set up water and so on, and then he sits down. And so now he says that he's going to instruct them in the form of, this would be like a question and answer format. So he's saying that he's going to present them with the teaching, and then ask them if they understand. If they understand, they should say yes. If they do not understand, they should say they do not understand. And then if they have any questions, they should ask their questions. Okay, so now Venerable Nandaka begins the instruction. And this is a topic which we've covered several times already, so it's not a new presentation. But we'll say that Venerable Nandaka introduces some quite interesting similes, which I think are unique to the sutta. Okay, so he begins by saying, with the questionnaire, asking them, presenting the teaching, as the Buddha often does, by asking them questions and then drawing out the reply. So he says, what do you think is the eye, goes through the other senses, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, permanent or impermanent? And so they say they're impermanent. Then is what is impermanent, here is translated suffering or happiness, which is not really satisfactory, but there's no really satisfactory way to translate this precisely. The Pali is yad anicham dukkham va sukham va. So whatever is impermanent, is it dukkha or sukha? So we can say dukkha, not so much suffering, but unsatisfactory, inadequate, deficient, incapable of providing solid, secure, lasting happiness. That would be a kind of capsule definition of dukkha. So suffering is one aspect, but a broader meaning of dukkha is that which is incapable of providing genuine, lasting satisfaction and security. And then the opposite of this is more than just happiness, but it would be lasting, substantial, genuine, secure happiness, happiness which is invulnerable to change and to transformation. Okay, so then the nuns say, since they already are quite well acquainted with the Dhamma, so they say that it's dukkha. So the six sense faculties are dukkha, they're unsatisfactory. And then Nandaka asks, what is impermanent, suffering, or dukkha, and subject to change? Is it fit to regard this thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And so they respond, no, Bhante. And so here, in this just brief questionnaire, Nandaka has covered what are called the three universal characteristics. So we go from impermanent, what is impermanent is flawed, defective, unsatisfactory, and what is unsatisfactory, what is impermanent and unsatisfactory, cannot be regarded as myself. Okay, so Nandaka goes through all of the six internal sense bases or sense faculties using the same procedure, the same question and answer format. Okay, so then Nandaka approves of their answer. He says, good, good sisters, so it is with the noble disciple who sees this as it actually is with correct, accurate, or proper wisdom. You know, it strikes me when I read this passage that there's a certain difference between the what I would call the classical Buddhist position and the kind of idea that has spread out in what's now sometimes called the modern mindfulness movement. The idea in the modern mindfulness movement is, yes, everything's impermanent, but you stay in the present moment and you enjoy the present moment. You know, so that when you just are mindful with what is occurring in the present, then everything is wonderful and beautiful and splendid and magnificent. And so you just sort of ride the waves, the changing waves of life, enjoying the present moment. And that is, well, the practice of mindfulness. You know, usually it's sort of disconnected with its from its origins in Buddhism. And so now, I was just reading a book the other, and I'm still reading it, by an American scholar. His name is Jeff Wilson. It's called Mindful America. And he traces the stages by which mindfulness originated in a kind of modernistic presentation of Buddhism to make Buddhism more appealing to, you know, modern educated Westerners. And then gradually, sort of, the Buddhism aspect gets pushed over to the side and the mindfulness gets separated off, until now we have mindful cooking, mindful parenting, yes, mindful sex, mindful business entrepreneurship, mindful mindful momming, being a mother, mindfulness and the single woman. Oh yeah, there was a book years ago, Sex and the Single Woman, was that it? Yeah, now it's Mindfulness and the Single Woman. There was a TV series, Sex and the City. I haven't seen or heard of a book yet called Mindfulness and the City. But anyway, the idea in the sort of modern mindfulness movement is that just being aware of the present moment is sufficient in itself, and that's the cause of joy and exuberance and bliss. Of course, when you're able to keep your mind in the present, then you experience kind of happiness, freedom, joy. Certainly that is the case. But the point of the Buddha's teaching is not just to keep to be mindful of the present moment, but to see that the constant change of every event occurring in the present is a kind of revelation of the intrinsic unsatisfactoriness of everything that arises through causes and conditions. And then the insight into the unsatisfactoriness of everything that arises, the impermanence and unsatisfactoriness, is for breaking the identification with it. That is, for seeing into the non-self nature of everything conditioned. You know, so now the mindfulness movement, sort of like one of the sub-themes, is through mindfulness one discovers one's true self. You know, one could, instead of getting weighed down by all of the streams of thought and false sense of identities that are imposed upon one by society, the expectations of others, by being constantly mindful of whatever one is experiencing, one discovers one's true self. But for the Buddha's approach, or what the aim that the Buddha's teaching is pointing to, is that through attention to the present, observing the impermanence and unsatisfactory nature of everything that arises, one thereby generates the insight that this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. Okay, so first Nandaka develops this question and answer format in regard to the six internal sense bases, that is the six sense faculties, the six instruments of perception. Then we come to the six sense objects, that is, he develops the same basic argument regarding forms, sounds, odors, flavors, tactile objects, and mind objects. So they're all impermanent. Because they're all impermanent, they're all dukkha, unsatisfactory. And because they're impermanent, unsatisfactory, subject to change, they are not fit to be taken as mine, I, myself. And the reason is that the nuns say is because we have already seen this well, as it actually is with proper wisdom, that the six external bases are impermanent. And I think from the standpoint of this discourse, it's significant that the nuns here are saying that they've already seen this well with correct wisdom, with proper wisdom. You know, so from this we could see that they're not beginners in the Dhamma, but they've already developed insight, wisdom. It's not clear what status of attainment they've reached, what level of attainment they've reached so far, but from this we could see that they've already developed strong and clear wisdom of insight. Okay, so we have six internal sense bases, six external sense bases, and then in the next section of the discourse, the same format is applied to the six types of consciousness, that is, I consciousness through mind consciousness. And again, they say that the reason that they recognize this is not mine, not I, not myself, because we have already seen this well as it actually is with proper wisdom, that the six classes of consciousness are impermanent. Okay, so now we have, in effect, these are the 18 elements, six sense faculties or internal sense bases, six external sense bases, six types of consciousness. So these are the 18 dhatus. Okay, now Venerable Nandaka is going to illustrate the point of the teaching using two similes. So first he gives a simile of an oil lamp that's burning. And now he says its oil is impermanent, subject to change. The wick is impermanent. The flame is impermanent. and the radiance is impermanent and subject to change. So now would anyone be speaking rightly who spoke thus, while this oil lamp is burning, its oil, wick, and flame are impermanent and subject to change, but its radiance is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. And so then the nuns say, that's not so, venerable sir, because while the oil lamp is burning, its oil, wick, and flame are impermanent and subject to change, and so its radiance or its light must be impermanent and subject to change. Okay, then Nandaka draws the conclusion and he says, so would anybody be speaking rightly who said these six internal bases are impermanent and subject to change, but the pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant feeling that one experiences in dependence upon the six internal sense bases is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change? Okay, just to map out the simile. I have to admit, I'm a little bit confused by this simile. The reason is that it would seem to me in the simile we have three things: oil, wick, and flame. And yet these are being used as an illustration just for the internal sense bases. It would seem to me to make better sense if one takes, for example, the oil to represent the internal sense bases, the wick to represent the internal sense bases, since the wick is the stable part of the lamp, the oil to represent the external sense bases, because the oil is something that you pour. I don't know if you've ever used kerosene lamps, but we used to use them all the time in Sri Lanka. So generally the wick is fairly stable. You have to change it once a month or so. But you always have to put every day or every other day, you have to put new kerosene into the lamp. And so you can take the oil to be the external sense bases, because whereas the sense faculties at least seem to be fairly stable, but the objects are always changing. I look around the room and different colors, different shapes, but the eye seems to be fairly stable. Then the flame is what arises based upon the oil and the wick. That would seem to represent consciousness.
I think what they mean by flame is a match. It's like lighting a match.
I don't think so.
Because out of oil and wick, you can't create anything. Both of them together will not give you anything till you light it with something.
No, I don't think so. Because
they can't create anything on their own together.
Yeah, but I think it's speaking about a lamp which is already burning. So it's taken for granted that the lamp has been lit. Yeah, so the flame is, well, you know what a flame is. It's that part which is shaped something like this, red, yellow, orange in color. then the light is what's distributed through the flame. So it makes better sense to me, instead of taking the whole simile just to represent the internal sense bases, to take each element of the simile to represent, one to represent the internal sense bases, another to represent the external sense bases, the flame to represent consciousness, because consciousness in a way is like a flame, which is, you know, in a sense, burning, always sending out the light of awareness. And then the light itself is here being compared to the feeling. But feeling arises always in the Buddha's exposition in dependence upon contact. So there's one element which is missing in the simile. If we take light, so we take oil to represent the external sense bases, the wick, internal sense bases. Okay, then it seems to me that the simile makes better sense. But then one element is missing from this alignment of factors. What is missing?
Suffering?
No. We have sense bases, internal, external, consciousness, feeling. I heard it's coming from someplace.
Contact.
You said it. Yeah, right. It's contact. So there has to be the in order for feeling to arise, there has to be the contact, which is the coming together of internal sense bases, external sense bases, and consciousness. Actually, maybe if we let consciousness as the flame being the sense that you represented as the match, mm-hmm. then contact will be the flame that flares up from the match. And you could work out the simile as...
Like, one thing you're talking about, the gateway to feeling or gateway to consciousness. The fifth element, which is
the contact. The contact is the condition for feeling. Contact presupposes consciousness, because contact is the coming together of consciousness with the object through the sense faculty. Okay, now all of these, according to the perspective of the Buddhist teaching, are impermanent. And so this is the way, it's not brought out explicitly here, but this is the way in which the Buddha, through the sort of strategy of his teaching, seeks to break the driving role of craving. So craving is the force which drives the cycle of birth and death, and craving is the origin of dukkha. And the condition for craving is feeling. And one latches onto feeling in the assumption or presupposition that the feeling is permanent, even though one can't believe this conceptually. But there's a kind of unconscious presupposition that I'll go on enjoying the feelings that are pleasant and enjoyable. And so by exposing the impermanence of feeling, when one comes to recognize the impermanence of feeling, then craving is without any object to latch onto. Because one sees even pleasant feeling, which is the primary motivation of craving, even that pleasant feeling is impermanent. And so when one sees into the impermanence of pleasant feeling, then craving will be overthrown, will turn around. And so this impermanence of contact, it's not mentioned explicitly in the sutta, but in the paragraph that begins where the nuns say, well, Nandika asks the nuns whether when the six internal bases are impermanent and subject to change, whether the pleasant, painful, or neutral feeling that one experiences in dependence upon the six internal bases can be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. Then the nuns say, not so, venerable sir, because each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition, and with the cessation of its corresponding condition, the feeling ceases. And that condition upon which the feeling arises, in each case, is contact. And contact is the coming together of external sense base, internal sense base, in consciousness. And so they are all impermanent, always changing. And so the contact that arises through them has to be impermanent, always changing. Okay, now we come to the second simile that Nandika uses. And as we'll see, he's going to apply this to the external sense bases, but it makes better sense to me if we take each part of the simile, just as we did with the simile of the oil lamp, and apply each part to a different element in this process of perception. Okay, so here we have a great tree standing possessed of heartwood. So its root is impermanent and subject to change. Its trunk is impermanent, subject to change. The branches are impermanent and subject to change. And its shadow is impermanent and subject to change. Okay, now could anyone say that the root, trunk, branches, and foliage of this great tree standing possessed of heartwood are impermanent and subject to change, but its shadow is permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change? Then the answer is no. And why so? Because the root, trunk, branches, foliage of the great tree are impermanent and subject to change. So its shadow must be impermanent and subject to change. So here we could do it. The branches and foliage actually go together. They form a compound. Yeah, in the simile, it's rather hard to distinguish which should be the internal sense bases, which should be the external sense bases. But let's arbitrarily say that the root are the internal sense bases. Because the sense faculties seem to be fairly stable, just like the root of the tree. But whereas the trunk grows out from the root, the external sense bases, form, sounds, and so on, don't grow out from the sense organs, but they have their own independent existence. Okay, then the branches and foliage, we could say, represent consciousness, which grows out from the interaction of internal and external sense bases. And then we have the shadow representing the feeling. And again, the nuns say that the external sense bases are impermanent and subject to change. Well, it's actually Nandigo says this, that this, because the six external sense bases are impermanent and subject to change, the pleasant, painful, or neutral feeling that one experiences depending upon the six external bases cannot be permanent, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change. So the point is that all the feeling that arises through the external sense bases will be impermanent. And that's because each feeling arises in dependence upon its corresponding condition. Again, it arises in dependence on a particular contact. And with the cessation of its corresponding condition, the feeling ceases. And it seems that this principle can be understood at different levels of subtlety. For example, you might say that if I'm looking at a red object, that in this case the form is lasting for some period of time, that the eye is lasting for some period of time, and that visual consciousness is lasting for some period of time, and therefore that as long as I'm looking at the red object, the contact that's experiencing the redness is persisting through that time. If I'm looking at a red object for 3 minutes, it seems that during that time, the contact and the feeling arising from that contact will be stable and lasting. But actually, according to the way of developing through the development of mindful attention to one's experience, one starts to see at subtler and subtler levels how, at subtler and subtler levels with increasing frequency, the contact is taking place, the consciousness is arising, the contact is taking place, and the feeling is arising and passing away. And so as one goes on attending to a particular sense object, or say a sensation, that sensation will start breaking up within one's awareness into units of sensation which are succeeding each other with extreme rapidity, extremely quickly. So we could apply this, let's say, not to a perception of a color, but to the sensation of a painful feeling that might arise, say, in one's legs or back as one is sitting in meditation. So if one just attends to that feeling, that sensation, in a gross way, in a coarse way, it seems like it's one block of painful sensation, which might be lasting, say, 3 minutes. But if one attends closely to that sensation with continual mindfulness, one will see that the sensation actually consists of what I call momentary flashes of sensation. And each of those flashes of sensation just arises and passes away. And so as the attention becomes more subtle, more refined, then one becomes able to perceive the arising and passing away of sensations at finer and finer levels until one comes down to what we might call the micro level of perception of impermanence, where the phenomena seem to be arising and passing away even hundreds of times within a second. And so one can notice this more easily with regard to a sensation like the pain, but the same applies to the perception of, say, the visual perception of a colored form, the audio perception of a sound. I remember years ago when I was doing intensive meditation in Sri Lanka, then the awareness had reached that subtle level, and then there was a bird chirping outside the kuti where I was staying. And the way I heard the chirp of the bird, you know, usually we hear chirp, 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 but in my perception it turned into a, like breaking down to a chip, 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 and then another chip, 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 chip. So, because the attention becomes very, very refined, so the perception gets dissected, in a sense, broken down into subtler and finer units of perception. Okay, so now we've covered the questionnaire dealing with the internal sense bases and the external sense bases, each one illustrated by their similes. Maybe at this point I'll ask whether anybody has any questions or comments.
Mathieu, I was wondering, why did Nandaka have this different way of teaching the beginnings?
You mean using these similes?
These similes and a question and answer format.
Well, actually, question and answer format is not so unusual. The Buddha himself often uses it. Why he chose that, I don't know. But it seems that the nuns, actually they say that they were very pleased that Nandaka was using that format. Yeah, in paragraph 5 he says, "We are satisfied and pleased with the master Nandaka in that he invites us even with this much." Sounds a little condescending. But maybe they like the question and answer format because it gives them a chance to express themselves rather than just passively listen to a discourse. So any questions? Barbara? Please take the microphone.
I'm so sort of stuck on Nandaka's wanting to avoid teaching the Kunis, especially if he's known as a good teacher of the Kunis. And I'm wondering if, although it doesn't get in the commentaries, the two things that make sense to me are that even as an arhat, could he possibly have a fear of public speaking? I mean, this is 500 bhikkhunis.
Yeah, actually that's what occurred to me. If we put aside the commentarial story,
yes,
it could have been as an arhat, he wouldn't have a fear of public speaking, but maybe there's some residual degree of discomfort with it. Maybe, yeah. And 500, we always have to take the number 500 in the text with some reservation. It seems to be used as a blanket term for a large number. You know, like sometimes you read that this disciple turns up with 500 of his students at the same place, another great disciple turns up with 500. So, can't imagine how, you know, so many people gather at the same place at the same time. But it seems to be just a way of indicating a large number. Did I see somebody else? Ravi? He's here, over here.
Maybe I can be old enough. One day, this concept of external self-basis, internal self-basis, and consciousness, to me it's pretty simple. Maybe I'm too simplistic. Without all these root, trunk, and branches, whatever. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, the external, the internal sense basically would be the eye, the ear, the nose, whatever, right?
Yeah.
Without that, we won't see, we won't figure out what. The external sense based would be things that are happening around, right? If those rays of light, sound, whatever, is not come,
then nothing to hear, or see, or whatever.
Right? The external sense based. Then the other one, of course, would be all this would not take place unless it's consciousness.
The connection. The eye, a dead person has.
Dead person also has an eye, but they can't see the dead person. Yeah?
Your sight or eye consciousness.
So your consciousness, nose,
taste, whatever.
Body, and mind.
So when you consider that, it's
very simple. If you have these three things, you won't be able to. There won't be contact and there won't be feeling.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, even if I don't understand these root, trunk, branches and everything.
Maybe I'm too simplistic.
No, that's okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Stephen.
Okay, I have a question about the contact.
Yep.
You were describing an increasingly refined sort of perception of objects and how that can sort of gets broken up into more and more refined packets. But my question is, are you describing these sort of more and more awareness of these sort of cittas, or is it also that we're perceiving the inherent instability of the objects that are also changing, or is it sort of a complicated interplay of the two?
I would say it's a complicated interplay of the two, that the objects themselves are always changing. I mean, we know this from contemporary like physics, like the object that seems to be stable and solid and persistent, it's a bundle of energies which are sort of locked into atoms and molecules, and then the atoms consist of subatomic particles, which are just bundles of different charged energies. So it's on the objective side, and then also on the subjective side, it's the cittas that are cognizant of those sense packets of sense data that are changing.
Thank you.
Speaking about impermanence, it seems we need a new battery for that clock. It's been 10 o'clock since I stepped in. Not right now. No, not right now. No, don't do it now.
It's permanent.
I just keep on glancing up to see how much time I have. And the class has just started. Okay, I want to move in now to finish up the discourse.
10 to 11, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I have my Enzo clock in front of me. Okay, if anybody is rather sensitive, I think it's better not to stay for this simile. Okay, here we have the simile of a skilled butcher or his apprentice would kill a cow and carve it up with a sharp butcher's knife. Okay, this I have a little trouble visualizing. So without damaging the inner mass of flesh and without damaging the outer hide, he would cut, sever, and carve away the inner tendons, sinews, and ligaments with the sharp butcher's knife. Does anybody have any experience being a butcher? I don't see how this is possible without damaging the flesh, the hide or the flesh. But anyway, you've been a butcher.
Not at all. But isn't that somewhat like boning a duck? I mean,
I don't know about boning a duck.
No, but boning a duck, you take the bones out, yeah. And you have a duck that looks like a duck.
Mm.
Nothing else is gone. But
I see. So there is a way to. There must be a way to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, so he would somehow cut, sever, and carve away the tendons, sinews, and ligaments with the sharp butcher's knife. Then having carved all of that away, he would remove the outer hide and cover the cow again with the same hide. And would one be speaking rightly if one were to say, this cow is joined to the hide just as it was before? And so the answer, of course, is no. Because even though he were to cover the cow again with that same hide and say the cow is joined to the hide just as it was before, that cow would still be disjoined from that hide. Okay, so now Nandaka fills in the simile. He says, I have given the simile in order to convey a meaning, and this is the meaning. The inner mass of flesh is a term for the six internal sense bases. The outer hide is a term for the six external sense bases. And the tendons, inner tendons, sinews, and ligaments is a term for delight and lust. This is Nandi Raga. And the sharp butcher's knife is a term for noble wisdom. The noble wisdom that cuts, severs, and carves away the inner defilements, fetters, and bonds. Now let's try to put the simile together. Okay, Nandi Raga, what's called here delight and lust in Pali is Nandi Raga. Now if you know the Pali formula for the Second Noble Truth, or even if you're very familiar with the English translation, the Second Noble Truth is the origin of dukkha, of suffering. So what is the origin of suffering? It's tanha nandi raga sahagata. So it's craving, which is associated with or conjoined with nandi raga, delight and lust. And so nandi, or delight and lust here, is representing craving, the Second Noble Truth. And so craving is spoken of as though it were like the tendon which joins together the internal and external sense bases. And it seems to me that the simile doesn't really work perfectly, because if you sever, if you kill a cow and you sever the hide from the cow and then join the hide together after cutting away all of the ligaments, you just have a dead cow with the hide and the flesh. But when you cut off the craving or desire and lust delight and lust. You don't just have inanimate internal sense bases and external sense bases. You still have a living person whose sense faculties are still, everything is still working pretty much as before. The only thing that's missing is that there is no delight and lust occurring through the mind, through the six sense bases, through the six internal sense bases, for the six external sense bases. So the person who's eradicated delight and lust or craving is the arhat. And the arhat is not just like an inert object, like the joined together cow, but he's still a human being with the ordinary sensory functions, but just that there's no craving operating through the sense faculties. But maybe we don't have to try to apply the simile too literally, bit by bit. But the point is that I would say that what joins, it makes better sense to think of the desire and lust as what joins one existence to another. So what joins the six sense bases in this life, the six internal sense bases, to a six sense bases arising in a future life is the craving or desire and lust. So as long as there's desire or craving operating through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, that craving will bring about a re-arising at death of a new set of sense bases, whereby the craving can continue to function. And when craving is eliminated, then with the breakup of these six sense bases, here and now in this life, then there's no arising of a new set of sense bases. There's another simile that occurs, several times in the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses on the six sense bases. This is called the simile of the pairs of bulls. Maybe some of you know it. Okay, so the simile goes that there is a black bull and a white bull which are joined by a yoke. And the question comes up, is the black bull the fetter for the white bull, or is the white bull the fetter for the black bull? And what is the answer? Right. Neither is the fetter for the other, but what is the fetter?
The yoke.
It's the yoke that joins the white bull and the black bull together. And so the fetter here, according to the sutta, is, again, it's desire and lust. In that case, it's chandaraga. And so the white bulls, or the white bull represents the six internal sense bases, the black bull represents the six external sense bases, or vice versa, I don't remember. But the important point is that it's the craving that joins the two together. Of course, even when craving is eliminated, actually, again, the simile doesn't work perfectly, because there's still the six sense bases, internal sense bases, perceiving the six external sense objects. Okay, but the important point here is that what eliminates that craving, which is the fetter, which is here the inner defilements, fetters, and bonds, what cuts away these defilements, fetters, and bonds is the noble wisdom, the Arya Panya. And now the discourse takes a little shift in that Nandaka here introduces the seven factors of enlightenment. And according to the commentary, he introduces these seven factors of enlightenment in order to show the means for generating that noble wisdom. And so he speaks about, he says that there are these seven enlightenment factors through the development and cultivation of which a bhikkhu, or he should say in this case say a bhikkhuni, by realizing for herself with direct knowledge, here and now enters upon and abides in the liberation of mind and the liberation by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints or the asavas. And so what are the seven? Here, a bhikkhuni develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, then develops the investigation of phenomena enlightenment factor, the energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity enlightenment factors, each of which is said to be supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. Okay, so here the goal is set up, the end of the unfolding of the enlightenment factors is the liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom that are taintless but without the asavas through the destruction of the asavas. So that is the goal. And then that goal is reached through the unfolding of the seven factors of enlightenment. And according to some texts, the commentaries, the Abhidhamma, amongst the seven enlightenment factors, one of them is identified with wisdom. Which of those seven enlightenment factors is identified with wisdom?
Equanimity.
No.
Investigation.
Right, it's the investigation of phenomena. And so, but it seems to me that when the expression investigation of phenomena is used, this is indicating what I would say would be an elementary stage of wisdom. Because otherwise it seems to me a bit strange that it comes the second place in the seven factors of enlightenment. Like wisdom, one thinks, would come at the end. But we could see that this investigation of phenomena starts off maybe just playing a rather elementary role, but as the seven factors of enlightenment unfold one after another, it doesn't mean that the earlier ones are discarded and given up, but each of them merges into the others as they unfold until one has the seven enlightenment factors working together simultaneously. And then when they're all working together, then that investigation of phenomena enlightenment factor then comes into full maturity and becomes that penetrative, noble wisdom which is able to eradicate the defilements. Okay, I don't want to go into a detailed discussion now of the enlightenment factors, because I want to come to the end of the sutta, because there's an interesting end to it. Okay, so now the Venerable Nandaka had finished his discourse, and so he dismisses the bhikkhunis. Actually, they're in their own place, so they should dismiss him and say, okay, you're finished. But he says, go, sisters, it is time. Okay, so then the bhikkhunis, delighted and rejoiced in his words, they got up from their seats, paid homage to him, and then departed, keeping him on the right. Okay, then they go to the Buddha, and they pay homage to the Buddha, and then the Buddha tells them, go, it is time. Okay, then after the bhikkhunis had left, I'm in paragraph 15 now. The Buddha addressed the bhikkhus and he says, just as on the Upasatha day of the 14th, people are not doubtful or perplexed as to whether the moon is incomplete or full, since then the moon is clearly incomplete, so too those bhikkhunis were satisfied with Nandaka's teaching of the Dhamma, but their intention has not yet been fulfilled. Actually, when the text speaks about the 14th, it's not the actual Upasatha day, but this is speaking about apparently a period in which there is the Upasatha, the actual full moon day, will come on the 15th of the fortnight, which is the two-week period in which the moon is waxing, gradually increasing in size. So the moon becomes the full moon on the 15th, and if we look up on the 14th of that period, the waxing half month, we see the moon is very bright, very shiny, but there's still a little dark sliver, so it's not yet complete, not yet the full moon. And so the Buddha is comparing the impact of Nandaka's discourse on the bhikkhunis, that they were satisfied, but their intention or purpose was not yet fulfilled. So it's like they are like the moon on the 14th day, almost full, but not yet complete. But then the Buddha gives Nandaka another task to undertake. He says, well then, Nandaka, tomorrow you should go and instruct the bhikkhunis in exactly the same way. Okay, so Nandaka has to agree, since the command is coming from the Buddha. The next day he goes and gives a discourse, according to the text, exactly the same discourse to the bhikkhunis. And then they leave exactly, and they part exactly in the same way. And on this occasion, the Buddha addresses the monks and he says, just as on the Upasatha day of the 15th, this is the real Upasatha day, when the moon is at its fullness, people are not doubtful or perplexed as to whether the moon is incomplete or full, since then the moon is clearly full, so those bhikkhunis were satisfied with Nandaka's teaching and their intention has been fulfilled. Then the Buddha says, even the least advanced of those 500 bhikkhunis is now a stream enterer, no longer subject to perdition. This I would now render to the downfall. That means rebirth in the lower realms. So they're no longer subject to rebirth in the lower realms. They're now fixed in their destiny and headed for enlightenment. Okay, this is the way the ending of the discourse has come down in the Pali version, but I checked with this study by my friend Bhikkhu Analeo, who's done comparison of the Pali versions of the suttas with their counterparts in other traditions. And he said that according to, there's a version in the Samyuktagama, that's the Chinese counterpart of the Samyutta Nikaya. Samyuktagama, I believe, belongs to, it might be in the Mula Savastivada school. And similarly, in the Mula Savastivada Vinaya, the Mula Savastivada, there are different schools of early Buddhism. The Pali school is one school. There's the Savastivada, Mahasanghika, Mula Savastivada, Dharmaguptaka, a number of other schools. So according to the Samyuktagama version, on after the first teaching, the nuns reached the stage of non-returnership. That is, they became anagamis. And then after the second discourse, they all reached arhatship. And to my mind, that corresponds more closely with the simile of the moon. Because if the moon is almost full, then it seems, let's say, if the full moon is arhatship, that's the fulfillment of their intention or goal or purpose, then being almost full means being close to arhatship, but not quite there. And so this version says, after the first teaching, they all became non-returners. After the second teaching, all became arhats. And then, this is an interesting point where there's a contradiction in the Pali tradition itself. The Anguttara Nikaya commentary, in the place where Nandaka was appointed the monk who is foremost in instructing bhikkhunis, then there's a commentary to that. And the commentary says that after Nandaka gave his first teaching, all of the nuns became stream enterers. And after he gave the second teaching, they all became arhats. So, you know, I'm not in a position to say which is true, which is not, but just it's useful to see that there are different presentations or different perspectives on the outcome of the two teachings. Okay, if there are any questions, we could have a few minutes of questions, and then we'll come back after the meal for more questions and discussion.
Is there any other sutta with Nandaka instructing? I'm still perplexed because I think he gave very rudimentary instruction.
Excuse me? With very rudimentary instruction.
So I'm just wondering, I mean, was there some misperception about the ability of women to understand the depth to which you could go into, you know? I mean, we are trying our best to make parallels here. Given the similes. So is there somewhere else that Nandaka has given instruction that we can...
Yeah, I think this was a point that I brought out at the beginning, that so far as I'm aware, this is the only place where he's shown giving a discourse to bhikkhunis, and yet in that list of the foremost disciples, the Buddha appointed him foremost in instructing bhikkhunis.
Right.
So it seems that what we get sort of collected into the text are just like specimens or examples. So there must have been many other occasions when he taught bhikkhunis. And here, Mahaprajapati and the 500 bhikkhunis, according to the tradition, these would have been the women, the 500 other women, that came from the Sakyan and Kolian clans. Those were the Buddha's family members who joined Gotami when she came down to request bhikkhuni ordination. So these would be the first 500 bhikkhunis. So I would assume that if Nandaka was skilled in instructing bhikkhunis, then when new groups of bhikkhunis came and received ordination, Nandaka would get the injunction, go give them a teaching. Yes?
But I would say that that he could get that reputation simply on the basis of these two talks. If he took these 500s to arhatship on two talks, that's a very good teacher.
Yeah, but I would say that, you know, like each of the other qualities that are extolled in those who are appointed, well, most of them are based on like repeated displays of that skills. But there are a few others in which we see the person, whether I'm thinking of a particular layman who's distinguished as the foremost in offering delightful meals. And it's just like one sutta in which he offers delightful meals to the Buddha and the Sangha. And so he's picked up and given that position as foremost in offering delightful meals on the basis of one sutta. Okay, so if there are no urgent questions right now, before we do the sharing of merits, one thing I want to point out is that next week, next Saturday, this is April 9th, Buddhist Global Relief will be having its annual fifth annual concert to feed the hungry. This is an event which is held every year. It's one of the main fundraising events for Buddhist Global Relief. And this will be a concert. I don't know who the leading figures in the jazz world are now, but one musician is named Fred Hirsch, who's a Grammy Award-winning jazz pianist. Do you know the name Fred Hirsch? Stephen? Yeah.
Yes, I've heard it.
You do know. A Grammy-nominated pianist, Fred Hirsch, and then a Colombian folklore band, a Brazilian percussionist, and then singer-songwriter Becca Stevens. But it doesn't matter whether they're famous or not. The important thing is to come if you're able to do. And the tickets are not so expensive this year. They're $25, $15 student or maybe retired person charge. So I will leave the cards out here. So please take a card and please do come to the concert if you're able to. And next Saturday morning we will have the class and we will be taking sutta number, I believe it's 148. It's a very profound discourse on the six groups of six. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas or the fierce spirits, the nagas, and with other beings. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa chiram rakantu sarasanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta manumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta manumodipa chiram rakantu manparam. Etavata chamhevi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata chamhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe saranumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanyino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, so I'll end with three half bows. I don't see the chime. Okay, so I'll do it verbally. Okay. One, two, three.
out of context.